You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
We're going to go ahead and get started. If everyone could please take their seats. I'm going to be welcoming my colleague, Scott Kennedy, to come up here and to be our lunch speaker. Scott's been working on this project for several months now, looking at sort of Taiwan's effort to reorder its global economic relationships and think about the implications of doing so for not only its trade relationships in the region, its relations with the U.S. Economically and otherwise, and globally. So with no further ado, I'd like to welcome Scott to the podium. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Now that you've eaten a lot and your stomachs are busy digesting, I'm going to try further to put you asleep. And I've been interested in Taiwan, obviously, a really long time. I was a student there in 1989, lived with a family in downtown Taipei. That year that I was there, I spent studying Chinese, teaching English, playing pool, not necessarily in that order of priorities, but you would be surprised that when you play pool, the opportunities you have to use complex sentence structures are amazing, because if you don't, so there's a whole lot of practice. And I remember playing in the pool hall and someone describing to me that I was describing them my American life and that I moved out when I was 18, to which they responded, "Well, don't your parents love you?" to which I said, you know a lot more than you should. No. In 1991, I was did my first trip to Huangshan. While I was climbing up, I ran into this gentleman from Taiwan. And he was really frustrated, not because Huangshan is tough to climb, but he just felt so out of place in mainland China. And he showed me his watch. And he said, "These people, they don't value this watch." And he held up this what must have been in a very expensive watch, not knowing that 30 years later, doing something like that, if it was caught on WeChat, would get him busted. But and he said, not only did they not understand the value of this watch, we don't have the same values, Jiajiguan. And I thought, having lived in Taiwan, traveled in China, I could see his point. But that was a really interesting turning point in cross-strait relationship, because he was followed by hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Taiwanese, and then billions in trade and investment. And Taiwan's economy has been tightly integrated into China's economy since then. Now, at the time, most people thought this was a good thing. They thought globalization is good for growth, right? Makes things more efficient. You compete for and do better, get better value. Tom Friedman had his McDonald's theory of peace, if you remember, that greater economic interdependence reduces the chances of war. I think there are plenty of McDonald's in Taiwan and across China. But that's not the dominant idea now, especially in Taiwan. The free movement of goods, money, and people create dependence. Vulnerabilities is the way many people in Taiwan now think about this. And if you look at polling, and in Taiwan, people are polled there. I don't know, how can they be polled so often? And I've got some of the data here. This question on dependence on China isn't actually asked as consistently enough as I'd like, and it's asked in a few different ways. But it basically shows that there's lots of anxieties about the relationship. Yes, on the one hand, people think that greater ties help the economy. On the other hand, they think overdependence is a bad thing. Of course, if you put it in the if you ask the question, is overdependence a bad thing? Usually, people will say, "Of course, it's a bad thing." I talked to one senior official in Taipei on one of my research trips, and he told me that the problem isn't dependence or interdependence. It's what he called asymmetric dependence. I was trying to understand what asymmetric dependence was. I think I got the general idea, but he had a hard time articulating specifically what asymmetric dependence is. There's no really good political theories in political science or international relations scholars that really explain that. Taiwan's the only place I've ever heard the word red supply chain. I used to hear the word red and China tied together in the United States, but that kind of stopped in the early 1990s. And in Taiwan, it's one of the most common phrases now to describe the fears of this dependence on China. So that gets me thinking, you know, what is this relationship and this concern, and what could Taiwan do about it? So now the title for today's talk that was in the materials really doesn't do justice to what I want to talk about, and doesn't do justice to my research assistants. So I want to thank and point out Brian Bumpus and Cho Ming Da, who are here in the audience today. Everything that I'm going to say that is accurate, they get credit for. Anything that's wrong, I'll take full responsibility for. And so today what I want to do in a short amount of time is answer these three questions. How did we get here? How did we get to a situation of this engagement, deep ties? And then secondly, does Taiwan have anything to worry about? Are their fears well-grounded? And then thirdly, what can Taiwan do about it, or what are they doing about it, and what are the prospects for those actions? That's going to bring me to talk a lot more than about cross-strait relations. So the first question is, how do we get here? So as you know, Taiwan cross-strait policy has evolved over time. Originally, there was mutual antipathy, a state of war, very little linkages. You'll see this is on a photo I took in Jinmen, in Huanwo Heshan, you know, the calligraphy of Chiang Kai-shek because of state of war. And to the right is the little peephole you can look at to look at the enemy across the other side in Xiamen. This was in 2005. And it just so happened that my guide for that trip, actually, I saw her here today. So really terrific. So a different period when there weren't economic ties and integration. But that changed in the 1990s, and actually the first project I did when I worked at the Brookings Institution in the early 1990s for Harry Harding was a project on Greater China, and this idea that integration economically, socially, would spur political integration and be a positive thing. As we looked around at all the different, there were so many different ways this was described and different constituent units, but basically it was any of these things would be good for economic or political reasons, and this idea of being overly dependent was not in the forefront of people's minds. So, and as a result of that, you got the Wang Gu talks, or should I say the Gu Wang talks? I never know. It depends on which audience I'm in front of, who to say mentioned first. The PRC rolled out the red carpet for Taiwan, and when I say red carpet, I mean that in two senses: not just a lot of positive policies, economic policies, access to land, etc., tax benefits, but the united front policies as well. This had both economic and political motivations. Now, the China administration, when it came into office in 2000, started with an aggressive push to expand economic ties with the mainland, and they canceled the no haste, be patient strategy and caps on mainland investment. Beginning in 2002, Chen started to finally link his concerns with the political relationship to the economic relationship. But he still pushed forward with the three mini links, the Xiao San Tong, trade, air, and mail. And who spearheaded those policies for him early in his presidency? Well, that was obviously first the person that helped negotiate Taiwan's entry into the WTO, who then became the Minister of the Mainland Affairs Council, a person who is still significant in Taiwan politics today, I would suggest, President Tsai Ing-wen. Now, of course, things have changed. Now, under Chen Shui-bian, it's really interesting that Taiwan's export dependence on China rose to the highest point ever. It was surpassed 40% in the final year of his presidency. It's come down slightly since then. But even under the DPP, ties continued to form with very little slowing down. When Ma Ying-jeou came into office in 2008, he pursued to push things even further, institutionalize ties beyond the relationship that would supposed to adhere to WTO principles, since both are Taiwan and the mainland are WTO members, and so pursued ECFA, the Economic Cooperation Framework Agreement, which they signed, and then the various agreements that are part of that. And this is basically parallel to the WTO commitments as well. But it's with that those ties and the political disagreements in Taiwan that generated a lot of concerns and debates about what ought to be done. So there's a question then about whether or not Taiwan should be worried. And I think there's a two-part answer to this, which is one is about the past and the other is about the future. The first is, have cross-strait relations so far hurt Taiwan's economy? And the answer is that we really don't have a lot of good evidence to tell us that, in fact, that it's caused a lot of pain. People are familiar with the data that shows that there's a close relationship. The amount of trade, almost 40% of Taiwan's trade exports go to China, which is higher than anyone else. I think South Korea comes the closest with about 20%. And the amount of investment that's in China. But the linkages between those things and bad things happening in Taiwan, the evidence is really pretty darn weak. Now, the idea is that is movement of all of that manufacturing and investment to mainland China would be a disincentive to invest in Taiwan and would lead to a structural growth in unemployment in Taiwan. Some scholars note that unemployment reached 5.2% in 2002 and 5.9% in 2009. And investment dropped from 24.4% in 2000 to 18.3% in 2009. Well, 2002 could be linked as much to the pop of the dot-com bubble and lingering effects of the Asian financial crisis as much as to the supposed large sucking sound from China stealing jobs away. And as for 2009, that doesn't strike me as a normal year in the global economy from which to look at data to see why Taiwan's has problems with unemployment. Everybody in 2009 had a big, massive unemployment problem. The U.S. was obviously over 10%, even worse as well. So I'm concerned that we actually don't have enough data yet to confirm that this close dependence has really been problematic so far for Taiwan. And if you look at the general data on employment, which I can put up here, first you can see that employment, except for that little moment in 2009, has continued to rise in Taiwan, not in agriculture, but even in industry, there's been consistent growth in employment as well, of course, as in services. And if you look at the composition of the economy in terms of just jobs, which is what most folks are worried about, not just in here, but in Taiwan as well. Industry is still, the share of employment in industry has only dropped marginally over the last 15 years. So, and if you look at sector by sector, it's hard because there's not perfect data. Brian and Mingda have struggled as best they could to find data on sectoral employment and other statistics at the level of granularity that we want. But essentially it shows that even in the sectors like ICT, manufacturing, which have invested the most in China, moved the most factories to China, their contribution to GDP is still high. It's growing. Employment in those sectors is growing. The average monthly wages are still growing in those sectors. And in fact, I don't have the data here to show you right now, but in each of those sectors, there's a shortage of workers for the type of jobs they want. So not the other way around. But if you look at sectors like real estate, non-tradable sectors, those sectors are facing more problems. And those sectors that could be tradable, but decide for whatever reason they don't want to engage with the mainland, they're growing amazingly slowly. Part of the time I was in Taiwan, I talked to companies that are in medical equipment, which is strenuously avoided investing in China. The consequence of which they told me was, on the positive side, very stable, gradual growth. On the other hand, no booming growth. It's still a very small corner of the Taiwan economy, and that's strange to me because Taiwan has the world's best healthcare system, much better than the United States, and so the medical equipment industry in Taiwan should be growing and successful and be a platform for Taiwan to export and invest abroad, but it's not occurring. So I may sound Pollyannish, and especially since a lot of times I talk about all the problems of the Chinese economy and what it could create for everybody else. First, let me say there's, and of course, folks in the United States, we talk a lot about the problems with China's economy and the problems of globalization. And there's a very good study from 2013 that shows about a quarter of the drop in manufacturing jobs in the United States since 2000 are a result of Chinese imports. But Taiwan's in a different situation vis-a-vis China compared to the United States. Obviously, its exposure to China is much greater than for the U.S. But Taiwan's at a different part of the global supply chain. They're in the assembly and manufacturing primarily, whereas the U.S. is at a different spot. And Taiwan's been able to maintain that advantage. Secondly, mobility of labor. How many people from Taiwan have been able to move to China and continue working? Well over a million. In fact, TSMC, which holds almost 60% of the world's market share in semiconductor manufacturing, is just about to invest in a $3 billion plant in Nanjing, and half of those workers are going to come from Taiwan. All right. Mobile labor that Taiwan has that the U.S. doesn't. And I suppose a lot of people in this room who are from the United States who perhaps want to live and work in China, I know those numbers have gone up, but I don't think we'll ever get to the numbers for Taiwan. In addition, finally, Taiwan has very limited imports from China, and as a result has a huge budget surplus. I think most people are aware that even though both are members of the WTO, Taiwan still keeps a lot of barriers to Chinese imports, certain types of investment, some limits on travel and immigration, which the U.S. couldn't do. I know the U.S. is having this debate about whether they might be tougher on China. I don't think the U.S. it'd have to take a lot to get to the U.S. to be as tough on China as Taiwan is on China, I think. And so that puts the U.S. and Taiwan sort of having a different effect, the relationship. Now, on the negative side, this limitation of imports from China and the surplus that Taiwan enjoys actually could be a negative because it might generate higher prices in Taiwan. It might mean it would have a negative effect on wealth and consumption in Taiwan, but it does have these other outcomes that are different from the United States. Now, looking ahead, I am actually much more worried about Taiwan and its relationship with China and the effect on its economy than it's been the case so far. And that speaks for a few reasons. The first is China's emphasis on growth through extensive intervention in the economy. You might have been able to, not be firm on this before, but China's really embraced state capitalism, entirely very techno-nationalist policies under Xi Jinping. And this rise of this red supply chain, if you want to call it that, can replace Taiwanese firms, exporters, and those that invest in China. And that could be a very significant challenge. And so if China grows in that direction, that could be a significant challenge for Taiwan. On the conversely, if China has a massive slowdown, like the problems it's had, and that lasts for a while, that would also be negative for Taiwan because China would import less, Foreign invested enterprises in Taiwanese would not produce as much. And this sort of black hole of the Chinese economy would suck Taiwan down with it, as it would many of its neighbors as well. And then lastly, the volatility of China, regardless of whether the problem of China isn't just whether it might do super well under state capitalism or have a debt blowout, but the volatility. And that up and down is going to have massive effects on financial markets, including those in Taiwan as well. So I'm less worried about the past than I am about the future of the relationship. So what can Taiwan do about this to address these worries and reorient its economy? I think the first thing that it can do is try and limit the vulnerabilities it has versus the PRC, which it's doing. So what are the kinds of things that Taiwan is trying to do? Well, not a whole lot of changes, but some at the margins. I mean, some constraints on investment of high technology, but very limited. So TSMC, when they announced their $3 billion investment in Nanjing that's coming up, they at the same time announced new investments in Taiwan as well. And obviously been lots of conversations about the need to protect intellectual property and careful of what you take across the strait. And I think you're seeing that in a lot of different industries in Taiwan. There's also constraints on further agreements. I think this morning there was already conversation about the oversight legislation so that any potential future deals across the strait had the endorsement and oversight of the legislative yuan and not just the president. So will these things have any effect on cross-strait economic ties? I think just a little bit, not a whole heck of a lot. Maybe in some individual cases, some business people will listen to the advice of the government, or they'll be careful before they plan. But I think for the most part, these will be symbolic moves as opposed to having a big effect on the direction of Taiwan's economy. Why are Taiwan firms in China and trading with China? They're the same reason Dell is there, Amazon is there, Eli Lilly, General Motors, and Ford, because one, China's got a big, massive market, and secondly, it's part of the global supply chain. And in ICT, in particular, where Taiwan dominates, you have to be near your partners, your suppliers. And so if Dell is there, TSMC is going to be there. If Qualcomm is there, Acer is going to be there. It's very good sense, just like why are so many firms in Silicon Valley, the same reasons. And so Taiwan firms are in China because everybody else is, and it would be crazy to expect them to change and move simply by themselves. Now, the investment environment in China has deteriorated. Every survey shows that. If you look at the American Chamber of Commerce, EU, others. And in 2014, it was reported that 13% of their members had moved or were planning to move out of China. In 2015, 25% gave that, so almost double. And from what I understand, when the survey comes out at the end of this year, it's going to be a lot more that are thinking about that as well. And so if those companies all move or think about it, then Taiwanese would too. But they're going to be pushed out of China. They're not going to be pulled in a different direction from Taipei, most likely. So the main question, Mark, that I have on this is instead about economic fundamentals per se, is what happens if the discussion that occurred this morning continues and Xi Jinping continues to give Taiwan a timeout, the way I give my kids, and doesn't want to engage and only continues at the working level, but nothing's achieved at a higher political level. How long do either side have patience, and what does that mean for regular business? Might Taiwanese business be inclined to move sooner from China because of this? So far, this hasn't had really any effect on Taiwanese businesses, and the ones I talked to said they do business based on the global markets, global circumstances, and cross-strait relations. They try to minimize its relevance in what they do. So if that red carpet disappears for Taiwan firms, then I think there could be a possible change. All right, so what's the second thing that Taiwanese are trying to do, and we've talked about that some, which is diversify their economic ties, particularly with ASEAN. They are trying, obviously, what they call a new southward strategy, and there was an old southward strategy, or southern strategy, that President Lee Teng-hui implemented from 1993 to 98 when he rolled out a whole series of policies aimed at ASEAN, South Asia, Australia, and New Zealand, related to investment protection and tax agreements, trade, banking, and a whole range of areas in signing agreements, and was actually relatively accomplished quite a bit, both at the commercial level and at the diplomatic level. The new southward strategy has in some ways replicated but gone in somewhat different directions. The most important, at least initially, after President Tsai came into office, was the creation within the presidential office of the new Southward Strategy Office. And it was the first director was a close ally of President Tsai's, Huang Jiefeng. In mid-August, this office issued guiding principles and an implementation plan on September 5th. And it has about a 4.2 billion NT dollar annual budget broken down in several ways. These are the most largest portions. But that's not a ton of money. In my house, we could figure out how to spend it, but for a government, it's probably not enough. But in addition to that, there's going to be significant emphasis on promoting trade, infrastructure projects, talent exchange, resource sharing, bilateral and regional agreements, and creating a warning system for the relationship that Taiwan has. Now, will this have an effect on Taiwan's relationship with others in Asia? Well, I'm unsure of this, how it will pan out. We'll just have to wait and see. There's some things that would concern me. The first is the stability of the policymaking process in Taiwan. Person who was appointed to head this office originally, Huang Jiefeng, has just been appointed to be Taiwan's new representative to Singapore in the wake of problems with the original appointee, should we say, that had him need to resign. And so no one was in that job. And then there was an announcement that this office is going to be merged into another negotiating office that will then be put under the executive yuan. So there's a question about sort of organizational, institutional leadership for this policy. And then they'll need to staff this office as well. The next issue is, can you persuade Taiwanese businesses? And when I was in Taiwan in last year in the summer and then just following in the press, I saw a variety of anxieties expressed from Taiwanese businesses about being pushed beyond what made business sense to them. And Taiwanese businesses are pretty independent minded, and so it's going to be a challenge to get them to do something which they wouldn't already think of, because they're also super smart. But I think the other challenge, I think, is persuading governments around the region to fully embrace this policy. And actually, let me put it there. The for all of these countries in the region, and I've put up there, I don't know if you can see this, this is the worst slide with all the numbers, the teeny little bitty things that we assembled, is the rank, where does Taiwan rank in terms of export importance for countries in the region? In 2000, for some countries in the region, Taiwan was an important destination. That's except for, I believe, Brunei. That's basically it. For everyone, Taiwan has dropped a lot of ranks. And these are just the rankings. If you go by absolute dollar terms, Taiwan is far less important, is just fallen for most. So it's going to be really difficult for Taiwan to persuade these countries around the region that the relationship with them is so important that they ought to consider alienating China as a result of these ties. I think that's a significant problem. The other is what kind of projects Taiwan is going to bring to these other countries. And so I've also gone and talked to representatives from the different governments in ASEAN. And some of them are worried that they will be given, that the projects that are going to show up on their doorstep are going to be labor-intensive manufacturing that generates a lot of pollution. Taiwan is a diverse economy, got lots of highly educated labor, factories, many different kinds of industries. So a lot of different types of businesses could go to Southeast Asia or elsewhere. But I think right now ASEAN, and you know, they feel like they're in a really good position that they can pick and choose. So it's going to be incumbent on Taiwanese companies and the Taiwan government to bring their best projects to Southeast Asia. Otherwise, that red carpet that they originally saw in China isn't going to be the same one that they get in ASEAN. So in addition to emphasizing the new southern strategy, Taiwan is also focused on entering into formal agreements as well as another solution to this overdependence problem. And everywhere I went in Taiwan, and you heard it today as well, this idea, this hope that Taiwan will be part of the second group of countries that join TPP. And they've been encouraged to do a gap analysis, which started under Ma Ying-jeou, that's continuing now. But implementing those changes isn't going to be easy. It's going to be very challenging to bring all of Taiwan's economy and regulation to where it would fit with TPP. But I think a bigger, this is more obvious challenge is you know, who's going to be willing to step up for Taiwan to say, yes, you should be able to join. I think the U.S., if all the you know, the facts were aligned properly, probably would be willing to say yes. It's just my guess, not knowing anything, but my guess. But could you say the same for Brunei, Malaysia, Australia, and Canada? What would their calculation be? I think it would be challenging. Taiwan's also, for a long time, been interested in signing a bilateral trade and investment framework agreement with the United States. And they point to South Korea's FTA with the United States as something that gives South Korea comfort, another market, and deeper ties to the global economy beyond Asia that helps balance its relationship with China. But those negotiations have taken a very long time. I think you could sum them up in one word. I don't know. I could ask others who are better, but ractopamine that goes into the ban on U.S. pork that contains this. The ban on U.S. beef containing this was lifted in 2012, but this other one's still there. And so those are big challenges. There's others related to technology policy, services, and others. But nevertheless, the negotiations haven't moved forward. So what can Taiwan do beside these things? And so where they have the most power to make a difference with their economic future is domestically, with what goes on in the island. So the first thing that you hear about with Taiwan is it doesn't have enough electricity or clean water, and it needs that in order to encourage factory production and things. And one of the clearest policy signals that the new government gave since it came into office is the goal of going non-nuclear no later than 2025. That's extremely admirable. It's a decision made on principle. But it also creates a lot of challenges for a place like Taiwan that has a difficult time creating certain types of renewable energies, like from solar, for example. So the answer is supposed to be a combination of renewables, natural gas, and conservation. And people who do the math on this say, well, it's going to be really hard to make that equation work to have enough power to propel Taiwan. If you think of a company like TSMC that uses so much electricity in their foundries, that's a big challenge, and I don't have a good answer. There's efforts to reduce regulation and open markets. It's not going to happen though quite quickly. But the other issue with domestic politics is just sort of the seeming, I wouldn't call it indecision, which is what some write about in the press, because I think actually there's been a lot of decisions made, and President Tsai has only been in office a little over 100 days, but I think it's not that there's not been decisions. It's that decisions go back and forth. There's a decision made in one direction, and then it's a decision to change in the other. And sometimes that change is dependent on who's protesting today and who's yelling the loudest. I get that at home, and I try to hold, but then I change, and then, you know. I think it's very difficult. I think the Thai government is still getting their bearings on not just what their long-term goals are and principles are, but how they can still deal with the day-to-day challenges that people in Taiwan face and balance those things. There's this emphasis also on new strategic industries and trying to replicate the success of ICT. And that seems, and that is, a lot of people talk about pharma, biopharma, and these other sectors. It's going to be a challenge for Taiwan to replicate the success of ICT, no matter how much they try. And it's really difficult to pick winners, no matter how successful you've been. And the success industries that have been chosen as part of these new strategic sectors, from what I can tell, they weren't scientifically chosen. They were chosen in part because they were important gaps in Taiwan, but not necessarily because Taiwan would have a comparative advantage in producing these. And then in terms of where they're supposed to be produced, they were sort of spread out across the island, I think, is sort of to help the entire island as opposed to just sort of the northwest part of the island, which seems to get most of the investment. So this is where Taiwan can probably get the most bang for its buck, but it's, you know, slowly moving against politically entrenched interest groups. And so, you know, I guess you have the challenges, you know, you could try to take on, you know, China and deal with Xi Jinping and those others, and a lot of attention has gone there, and work with Southeast Asia, but dealing perhaps with the domestic challenges, I think are going to be even tougher, but they're where probably I would put most of the my attention, actually. I think what I've done, I want to stop here because I've already gone on way too long, but I think my bottom line is, and I'm going to take a U-turn in a second, is that there's a lot of things that Taiwan needs to, that so far they haven't been as suffered as much from deep integration as people fear. On the other hand, they could, and there's a lot of things that they could do but would be difficult to do. And then I wanted to take one more little turn for you, and that is, despite the fact that it's going to be very difficult to modulate the relationship with China, with other neighbors, and with the U.S., I'm still not super worried about Taiwan's economy. Its economy is still, in my mind, a pretty healthy economy. These are the basic numbers up there. I know that it doesn't show you what your average people feel like in terms of real wages and things, but this is pretty good unemployment numbers. It's pretty good growth, and one of the numbers that I think is most important is private and domestic investment in Taiwan, which has been growing rapidly. You can't avoid the global economy when you're a country like Taiwan because of its size, and it's done a pretty remarkable job from where it's gone historically. And so, although there's going to be a lot of to and fro and a lot of criticism, and reading the Taiwanese press, I feel like this person deserves an F, and why? Of course the poll numbers ought to be going down. But on the other hand, give a credit because over the long term. So I'm still pretty optimistic about Taiwan, despite these real challenges that they face that would put any political system to the test. Thank you very much.